Okay, good morning, everybody. First of all, I want to thank Stuart Lesser, who just walked in, who is the sponsor of our program this morning. Him and his wife, thank you very much. And I want to welcome you and welcome Dr. Tamara Jacobowitz, who is got her PhD in Medrash, which explains the title of her morning topic, an introduction to Medrash at Penn. So a Wexner Fellow, she teaches at Trisha and at SAR. And as you can tell, this is going to be her last, speaking engagement outside of New York for a while. B'Shah Tova. Okay, B'Shah.
All right, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. It's been a phenomenal weekend in Toronto. Those of you who have been at Shaar Shamayim, we've had a blast learning with the community. And this is kind of the last hurrah, so thank you for the hospitality. You should all have your sheet. It says Introduction to Midrash, and because my doctorate is on Vayikra Rabba, I always find a way to sneak in the subject that I really love to talk about, which is Vayikra Rabba. In fact, doing an intro to Midrash in 1 hour is impossible. So instead of that, I've chosen a more narrow focus, and that hopefully will allow us to talk about some of the more broad issues in relationship to Midrash, and particularly collections of Midrash, reading Midrash inside. Okay, that was one thing that, at least for me, when I got to graduate school, was sort of a new experience. Midrash had always been something that I had encountered either, like I say, ba'avir, in the air, or through Rashi, right? Most of us, our exposure to Midrash is through stories that are told to us, stories that we find either to be very compelling or very outrageous, or stories that we hear through Rashi. But actually experiencing the study of Midrash inside the collections that they originate from is an entirely different matter altogether, and I want to give you an experience, a sense of what that is like. So if we think about the Midrash on Vayikra, give you a little bit of historical background. I don't have a whiteboard, so we're going to have to just imagine that I'm writing things on the board. I'm a high school teacher, and we have smart boards in every classroom, so this is a little hard for me not to have a way to write. Churban Bayit Sheni, what date comes to mind? 70 CE. All right. Post-Churban Bayit Sheni is when all of our collections of Midrash are dated. The first period of Midrash would correlate with the period of the Mishnah, so the Tanaitic Midrashim, which are also known as Midrashei Halacha. And then the second wave, which correlates more or less with the editing of the Talmud, is the Amoraic Midrashic collections. For both collections, though, if we focus on Vayikra for a moment, once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed and the Jews were no longer able to worship in the way that they had been worshiping, and they were dispersed, not entirely out of Eretz Yisrael, but certainly away from the center of Yerushalayim, what on earth do you do with a book like Vayikra? What's in Vayikra, first of all? Take a step back, okay? We're getting close, and as pulpit rabbis, I think the anxiety level rises the closer you get to Vayikra, right? Because it's many weeks in a row. What are you going to talk about? What do we have in Vayikra? What are the subjects? Okay, good. So Korbanot, Kohanim in the beginning, Mishkan, but then, of course, Beit HaMikdash. Very good. What else is in Vayikra? Tuma and Tahara, the laws of purity and impurity having to do with the body, right? Different things, contact with corpse, menstruation, different things that happen to the body that you have a response in relationship to purity. What else? Kedusha. Okay, so that's the one parsha, Kedoshim Tihiyu, that rabbis get excited about because there is good take-home messages we can take from. We still talk about, right, Kedoshim Tihiyu, what that means. Is it an extra mitzvah? Is it an enhancer of a mitzvah? But thinking of ourselves as Kadosh, as separate, as unique, Kadoshim to you. Good. Anything else that comes to mind from Vayikra? Okay, we kind of hit on the main topics in Sefer Vayikra. The problem is, without a Beit HaMikdash, you can't do Tum and Tahara. You can't keep Tum and Tahara, right? We only keep really one vestige of it with Nida today, but it has nothing to do with what you would do in terms of the Mikdash. You can't offer Korbanot. Kohanim's role is quite diminished. And so Sefer Vayikra poses a kind of practical problem. It's not the only problem the Jews face post-Korban, but from an exegetical perspective, right, what do you do when you come to this book? How do you read it? How do you make sense of it? So if you can imagine Jews living post-Korban, right, in the first and second centuries and continuing in third and fourth centuries, had a lot of disagreement about how to handle Vayikra, and for that matter, how to handle all of these mitzvot and ideas that no longer had practical value. I want to expose you to one possible approach. This is on source number one. Interestingly, the approach that we're going to read about is recorded in this collection. If you see on top, it says Vayikra Rabba, Margaliot, Parasha Zayin. Okay, anybody who's used Bar Ilan Responsa, the CD-ROM, you know what this is. If you haven't, you should. Hopefully, I don't know how you would have access to it. Maybe the shul owns the CD-ROM. You can find any Midrasha collection, for that matter, any of the classical texts. You want to browse, you want to search, you find the text, you can quote it, copy and paste onto your document. Vayikra Rabba, Margaliot, that means that's the name of the editor of the collection that the Bar Ilan database uses. And Vayikra Rabba, this is a collection that I studied. It dates to the Amoraic period, right? The second one that I mentioned. In Vayikra Rabba here, we get an explanation of an earlier approach. This is not what Vayikra Rabba does. But if Vayikra Rabba here talks about that approach. It's a little confusing. You'll see what I mean in a moment. All right. We're looking at number one within source number one. Rav Acha b'shem Rabbi Chilina bar Papa. Lefi she'Yisrael, kishahaya beit hamikdash kayam, hayu makrivin kol korbanot shabbat Torah, achshav mahu lihit asek bahen. Says Rav Acha, the name of Rav Chilina bar Papa, Lefi, how would you translate Lefi?
According to,
right, that's a little awkward as the beginning of a sentence, right? So we have to do a little finessing. Something like, since Yisrael, right? Or even almost when Yisrael, when the Beit HaMikdash was established, they would offer all the korbanot that are written in the Torah. But now, what's now? Post-Korban, mahu lihit asek bahen. Okay, who wants to try to translate that? Mahu lihit asek bahen. What? Okay, interesting. What are they, meaning Yisrael, to occupy themselves with? Good. Alternative translation.
Why should they occupy
themselves with that? Okay, so different focus. What should they do, or, right, say it again, how you put
why
it?
Why should they occupy themselves
with the korbanot, meaning the implication is, they can't be makriv, why should they be mitasek? Interesting, where else do we use lihitasek or lasok? Lasok b'mitzvah, lasok b'divrei Torah, right? In our brachot in the morning, brachot ha-Torah. Okay. Amar lahen ha-kadosh baruch hu, ho'il v'atem mitaskin bahen, ma'ale ani alechem ki'ilu atem makrivim otam. Okay, God responds. Now, God doesn't really respond in the Midrash, right? Rav Acha did not get nevuah. We know the nevuah ends with the Churban. What does it mean when Rav Acha's statement has God answering the question? It's so simple and so profound. What does it mean? What does it mean when a Midrashic rabbi quotes God? Yeah, I see a head over the back. Okay, and how does he know that? Where does he get the audacity or the chutzpah, right, to really say that God was the one who responded to him in this way? From the Masorah, okay, possibly, right? But the Masorah here would be, it's a little tricky because this is a new circumstance, right? But you're right, meaning his reading of the Torah. He hears God talking to him through the Torah. And what's his assumption? Vayikra was given to us as an eternal text. It's impossible that it has a time limitation. And therefore, if God gave us Vayikra, God can speak to us through Vayikra. And what God is telling us is, Ho'il v'atem mitaskin bahen, since you will be mitasek bahen, and now we definitely know what he means, which is in study. Ma'ale ani alechem, I will consider it to be as if you offered the korbanot. Okay, this is strategy number one. And this is the strategy that we actually find codified in the Tanaitic Midrash on Vayikra, which is called the Sifra. And what the Sifra does is it goes into ever more detail about every single pasuk, every single korban, meaning the more you study, the more you delve into the detail of the korbanot, it's as if you are offering them. We can call this study in place of sacrifice. That was approach number one, right? What might be another approach or a corollary to that approach, right? Think of yourselves as rabbanim who are faced with the challenge of not only making the text relevant for yourselves, but for your congregations, right? How are you going to get people to not disregard Vayikra, which is not an option, by the way, right? An option is not to simply say, let's skip those weeks. We don't need this book anymore. The Torah is eternal. The Torah is always relevant. Can't ignore it. What might be another approach that you would take or that you've seen? What have you seen rabbis do with Vayikra? Generally not this, right? They don't get up and go into the nitty-gritty detail, the myriads of details of korbanot. Okay, so allegorization, right? To find allegories in the Midrash. Now, that's interesting because, in fact, that's what we find Christian thinkers in this time period doing with Vayikra. We don't find it in a full kind of way from Chazal, but you will see in Vayikra Rabbah that there's a hint of allegorization, which means we're not ignoring the text, but we're finding maybe deeper values, underlying values that are latent in the text, and we're making that the subject. Good. What else could you do? What else could you say? You didn't realize you were going to have to talk so much at 9 o'clock in the morning. I apologize, but that's how it goes. Yeah, what do you think? Yeah, very nice. Very nice. So that's a second approach, which we find very much in Chazal, Tfilah Bimkom Korban. It doesn't really help you with Vayikra, right? It doesn't help you as a reader of Vayikra, but it's certainly an approach, it's a mode of worship that is actually what we all do, right? And very much you read the Gemara discussing the codification of tefillot, and we have our korban, our Shmona Esrei, and our tefillot keneged hakorbanot. The approach of Vayikra Rabbah is similar to what you said, which is the following: to take the psukim in Vayikra and to find in them hooks or hints for larger ideas, for underlying meanings that are highly contemporary and eternal. It does not mean pretending that Vayikra is not there. It does not mean attaching any idea, like my high school students often protest. Well, then where did the Midrash get that from? I could just attach that anywhere, right? It doesn't mean that. It means reading psukim carefully, reading words carefully, and using them as the springboard or the opportunity to talk about issues that are highly relevant for the audiences of the rabbis. This is not easy to do. This is why rabbis struggle with Vayikra, right? I think everybody on some level today tries to do that, find a hook somewhere that will allow you to talk about something that's really present in the congregation. What are those values? What are those underlying motifs that you're going to locate? Well, it depends on your strategy, depends on how you read the psukim. What's fascinating about Vayikra Rabbah, okay, now I'm going to introduce one more piece of terminology. If you follow, let's say you're interested in studying Bereishit, okay? And you've read Rashi, now you want to see Rashi's sources. One of Rashi's main sources is, of course, Bereishit Rabbah, which also belongs, go back to that list you made, it also belongs in the category of the Amoraic Midrash. But what's interesting about Bereishit Rabbah and what's somewhat maddening is that let's say you open up to, I don't know, Paragimel Pasuk Tetvav. You can expect to find a commentary on Paragimel Pasuk Tetvav. In fact, you can expect to find multiple commentaries on Pasuk Tetvav. Move on to Tetzayin, you'll probably find the same. Bereishit Rabbah is organized in order of the psukim, and it reads like an anthology of ideas moving forward through the psukim. It's called, fancy term, exegetical anthology, right? Exegesis, the study of sacred psukim, of sacred texts. It's helpful to the student. You go in order of the psukim. Vayikra Rabbah, by contrast, is called a homiletical anthology, meaning, let's say we open up to Vayikra Perek Aleph, and you open up Vayikra Rabbah to the beginning. What you'll find, actually, is many, many, many comments on the first pasuk and nothing on the rest of the perek, sometimes even the next two prakim, And the next parsha starts with the beginning of Perek Gimel. Very similar. Why homiletical? It's very similar to the way that rabbis construct sermons. Right? It's not because they're lazy and they get stuck in the first psukim and read no more. But very often, right, they're top heavy on one or two psukim, focus their sermon around that, and then everything else kind of goes, right, by the wayside. Vayikra Rabbah probably reflects how rabbis were actually giving sermons in the 4th and 5th century in the land of Israel. So if you wanted to, let's say, understand every single pasuk in Vayikra, you're not going to do well with Vayikra Rabbah. You'll know very well the very beginning, and then you won't have access to the psukim that follow. So we want to kind of understand how this works, how they do this, and we're going to see some examples inside Vayikra Rabbah. What I wanted to do with you first, kind of a fun exercise. If you look on your sheet, what you have in the second source are the first 9 psukim of Vayikra Perek Aleph. I apologize if there's no English. What I would love for you to do for a few minutes with the person sitting next to you or the people sitting next to you, spend a few minutes reading through those psukim and see what you could come up with if you had the task of writing a drasha to deliver in Tveria by the end of the week. What kinds of ideas do you find in the psukim that would be useful, right? Or which psukim would be good candidates for the building of a sermon around ideas? Now, one thing you should keep in mind, if you are a darshan living in the 4th and 5th century, you're an incredibly sensitive reader to text, which means that if words seem to be repetitive, if there are odd word choices, right, you're sensitive to the order of things. Use all those tools when you read these psukim, and let's see what we come up with as a collective. We can have maybe 1, 2, 3 every table. We could have 6 different drashot in a span of 10 minutes. So just find good candidates, see what might be the opportunity for the drasha. You don't actually have to come up with the drasha. I hate to cut off your learning early. We just transformed this room into a Beit Midrash. That was wonderful. Who would like to volunteer their ideas, their tentative beginnings for a sermon? Yeah. Go ahead. Very nice. All right. So not really knowing the details of the korban here, right, which is a korban ola. Okay. And you're right. The way it's presented in the psukim, it really doesn't give you the prior circumstances. And so you might use that as an opportunity to talk about not necessarily worship, but how you relate to your life circumstances in general. Right? Are you in control? Are you not in control? Is that what you meant?
Yeah. It's a beautiful
way. Very nice. Other ideas? Yeah.
Somebody else at this table, I won't take credit for it, suggested that Hashem calls to him. So therefore, there has to be a preparation from, you don't just throw yourself into a relationship. There has to be a summoning. There has to be a prior engagement with God. And then a relationship can be established.
Very nice. Okay, so looking at Pasuk Aleph, right, the first verse, Vayikra el Moshe, Vayadaber Hashem elav me'ol ha-mo'ed le'mor, that was a very sensitive read. There are two verbs there. First, God calls to Moshe, and then he speaks to him. Why the two? Right, so you're beginning to say, well, maybe there are two stages to the relationship. Of course, if we wait around for God to call on us, we'll be in trouble. Right? But some kind of, I don't know, the beginnings of talking about what does it mean to be in relationship with God. How do you hear your calling, right? And there actually are beautiful midrashim about that. To hear your calling, you have to be open to it. It's not about waiting to get the phone call, right? It's being open like Abraham. Very nice. Yeah?
Unblemished or mentioned more than once. So it feels like you really have to give something that means something to you, like the best of what you have. And there is echoes of Cain and Abel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which words did you find that in?
I was reading the English.
Okay.
Unblemished.
Oh, the unblemished. All right. Okay. Very nice.
Something perfect. Something. There really is a
Good. There are a lot of words that you could use for that kind of homily, which is to say, right, we don't just give schlock to God, right? The Cain and Hevel story is very complicated because it's not clear there at all what the problem was. But you're right, it's the same kind of sensitive read there in Bereishit. And you could use that as an opportunity to talk about what does it mean to give to God? Do we just give anything? Or do we give of ourselves in a different kind of way than we do with other relationships? Very nice. Nachon. That's what she said. Exactly. Yeah.
I played on the words ki achid mikem, and that you could give it the meaning, part of the meaning of when you approach God. In other words, the idea of coming closer to God, that mikem being from you, that you bring yourself from among yourselves, you bring yourself to God.
Good, because that also does seem like an unnecessary word in the verse. So you could use that as the beginning of the sermon. This is awesome. Yeah, another idea.
I found the fourth pasuk is very sort of almost mystical, that there's a requirement for you to physically transfer, almost like a transfer of some sort of essence of yourself in order to get the
So how would you use that for a non-sacrifice giving audience?
Well, it's also, you have to, obviously there, it's not just bringing a monetary gift, there has to be some sort of, I don't know if you want to say mental sacrifice or physical connection between you and the offering. If you don't have the offering, is that still possible from the intent, from like a mental exercise to have some sort of similar activity?
Okay, good. Right, some homilies could, I'm pushing you, I apologize, right? But some homilies could be focused in the details of sacrifice and not have a direct nimshal, a direct corollary outside the world of sacrifice, but really giving people insight into what it means to make a sacrifice. You can make your own connections, what kind of sacrifice that would be outside of the mikdash. Yeah. Good. So again, using kind of the physical contact as a way of talking about the intensity, right? Nobody's going the vegetarian route, right? But what does it mean to have contact with animals, which we don't have anymore, right? What that could do to your ethical sense at that moment of sacrifice, of offering. Yeah?
I wonder if times were very difficult, if there was a lot of persecution, if it might have been taken a different way of the looking at it as when we have to sacrifice ourselves, we should live our lives as perfectly as we can and be as unblemished and perfect as we can. And then if something horrible happens and at the time of persecution, we have offered ourselves in a perfect way to Hashem.
Very interesting. I don't know if you realize you're going, or this happened in Jewish history, right? In the medieval period, in particular in the Crusades, this Vayikra wasn't the subject of those kinds of sermons. The Akedah Yitzchak was. But again, putting the Jew in the place of the sacrifice as opposed to the one who is offering the sacrifice. Yeah. So where would you take that? Where would you take those questions? Yeah, she's talking about the details that are implicit even in these 9 verses about the Korban Olah, right? That's another way to go, to actually talk about the significance of what does it mean to offer an Olah on its own, right?
Procedures.
Okay, what does that all mean for the Olah? And then maybe what does it mean for your, I'm putting words into your mouth, but for your own spiritual practice, what their processes, right? Which you could really use these psukim as a basis for saying you don't go from 0 to 100 in your relationship with God. It's a step-by-step process. And you could even, there are no midrashim who do this, but we could write one, right, that taking the psukim, as this pasuk is referring to getting yourself ready for tefillah, this pasuk is referring to perfecting your relationships, whatever you wanted to make the corollary, that eventually you're building towards Unola. Okay, let's take one more idea. Yeah. Very nice. So it turns out that in Vayikra, Adam's not so unusual. But it's true that there are many other words you could use. Isha is never used, but Ish is certainly used. Why Adam here? We could stop in the tracks, and Chazal do this, right? Even though it appears elsewhere, what's the significance here? Does it take us back to Adama? Does it take us back to the original Adam and build a drasha around the word Adam? All right. Turn the page for a moment. Let's see an example of what Vayikra Rabbah actually does. Your suggestions were wonderful and very provocative. You know, I told you in the beginning that Vayikra Rabbah only looks at the first pasuk. Okay, so all of your suggestions that moved forward, right, would be for another kind of composition. Every single one of the 10 comments that we have in the first chapter of Vayikra Rabbah are all on the pasuk Vayikra El Moshe, most similar to what the gentleman in the back said about the Vayikra and the Vayidaber. So this is an example of a midrash that's on this pasuk. Now, take a look at it. Vayikra Rabbah, again, Margaliot, Parasha Aleph, same Bar Ilan database. This is Vav, so it's the sixth, I believe it's 10, from that parasha. Rabbi Tanchuma Patach, Yesh Zahav V'Rav Pninim Ukli Yakar Siftei Da'at. Now, I just told you this was going to be a midrash on the first pasuk of Vayikra. And yet, what does he do? He quotes a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs. What's that verb? Rabbi Tanchuma, that's his name, Patach. What does Patach mean? Opened. What is he opening? The discussion. All right. So what we find in Vayikra Rabbah and in other collections from the time of the Amoraim are these particular literary forms that are known in Aramaic as a petichta, in Hebrew as a p'ticha, and in English, although it's really not a useful word, a proem. What is a p'ticha, p'tichta, or a proem? It is a particular literary form which begins with a pasuk from somewhere far away, and through the interpretation of that faraway pasuk brings us eventually to what we'll call the pasuk of the day, which is Vayikra Aleph Aleph. Not that dissimilar from, again, what rabbis today do, beginning with usually not faraway psukim, but faraway ideas, a joke, right, something in sports, something in politics, right, and eventually by the end of the sermon you get to whatever is in the parasha, right? And there's an art form to this, because you can't choose something that's so obvious that everybody in your audience will just immediately know where you're going and fall asleep. You also can't choose something that's so far removed from the parasha that people are checking their watches and thinking this can take an hour and a half till he makes the connection to the parasha. Same thing in the petichta. The pasuk that's chosen from somewhere, again, far away in the Tanakh, needs to have some kind of hint of how it's going to connect to Vayikra, or the rabbi will take a very long time to make the connection. Mishlei is often quoted, as is Iyov, as is Tehillim. Why? What's in common with those Sifrei Tanakh, Proverbs, Psalms, and Job? Okay, good. Number one, they deal with moral problems, and so they are ripe for this kind of midrash that we've been talking about, which finds underlying meanings in psukim. What else is in common with those three books?
Everything's in it.
Okay, there's lots and lots and lots of ideas in them, and they're very non-specific, right? They're not, with the exception of Eov, the beginning of Eov, which has a very strong narrative, the rest of Eov is pretty much psukim that are, right, psukim of protest, of complaint. They're not connected to a particular story, and so they're fair game. They're very pliable. They're ready to go to be used as psukim that can be attached to other specific psukim. So look at our example from Mishle. Mishle is famous for, right, these pearls of wisdom that really don't connect necessarily to what comes before and what comes after. So you can just pluck it out and use it. Yesh zahav arav pninim, that means there is gold and many pearls. Ukle yakar sifte da'at, but I want to translate that. But the most valuable is lips of knowledge. Okay, the vav there is best translated as a but. There's a contrast here, right? On the one hand, there's gold and there's pearls. On the other hand, what's even more valuable is sifte da'at. This is classic Mishle, right? Mishle is all about praising the Torah in the form of wisdom. Okay, so Rabbi Tanchuma quotes that pasuk, and now he's going to interpret that pasuk in Mishle towards an eye leading to Vayikra, chapter 1, verse 1. Benoheg shebaolam, adam yesh lo zahav v'kesef, avanim tovot u'margaliot, v'chol chemda tova shebaolam, v'da'at ein bo, ma hanaya yesh lo. Benoheg shebaolam is the way of introducing a mashal, a parable, right? So in this case, he's saying, what happens in the world, it's the way of the world, that if a person has gold, silver, precious stones and pearls and every beautiful thing in the world, but he has no da'at, he has no knowledge, basically what good does he have? Right? It's worthless. Classic, right? Materialism versus intellectualism or spirituality. Right? You have nothing if you've amassed all the wealth and you don't have knowledge. Continues the Midrash. Bimatla amre, dea kanita machasarta, dea chasarta machanita. Matla, the Aramaic, right, you switch the taf and the shin, becomes mashal. Here a mashal in the sense of a proverb. What the Midrash is doing here is quoting like a common saying and saying what people say on the street, that's actually what we mean. No, we don't say this anymore, but apparently this was a common thing to say. If you have de'ah, if you have knowledge, what are you missing? If you don't have knowledge, what do you have? Right? Common way of making the point that Rabbi Tanchuma just made. Now here comes the actual dissection of that pasuk leading us to Vayikra, Aleph Aleph. And I bolded the words from the verse so you can see how the Midrash is doing this. Yesh Zahav, what is this referring to? Not a general statement about knowledge and wealth. It's referring to Hakol Heviu Nidvato Shalamishkan Zahav, Hadahu Dichtiv Vizot HaTruma Vigomer. Now, vigomer means etc., but often the actual words that you need are hidden inside the vigomer. So I will tell you what follows is, v'zot ha-truma asher chikhu me'itam zahav v'kesef u'nechoshet. What is the Midrash saying? That word yesh zahav, that's referring to the moment when the Jewish people all brought forward their donations to the Mishkan, as it says in the pasuk of Exodus 25, verse 3, and this is the donation that you should take from them, gold, silver, and copper. Okay? So we have here a quotation from Mishle, and the Midrash is now connecting it to another pasuk in Shmot. Right? Mishle was not talking about Shmot. The Midrash is making it relevant for Shmot. There were those who brought Zahav, and that was Bnei Yisrael. V'rav pninim, what's that referring to? Zen nidvatam shela nisi'im. Hadahu dichtiv ha-nisiim heviu, again the Vigomer, et ovnei ha-shoham ve-et ovnei ha-miluim la-ifod ve-la-choshen. These are our parshas this week, right? These weeks. This is talking about the donations of the nisiim, right, of the heads of tribes. What did they bring? They brought the precious stones. That correlates to v'rav pninim. Okay, so now we have the first half of the pasuk is you have gold and you've got pearls on the one hand. That's Bnei Yisrael and the nisiim. What do we do the second part of the pasuk? Ukle yakar sifte da'at. What is that referring to? Says the Midrash. Lefi shenafsho shelamoshe haita aguma alav. Amar hakol heviu nidvato shelamishkan v'ani lo heviti. Moshe was beside himself. He said to God, everybody brought their donation to the Mishkan and I brought nothing. Amar lo hakadosh baruch hu. God responds to him, Chayecha, I swear to you, Shediburcha chaviv alai mikol elu. Your dibur, what's dibur? Your speech, but in fact it's not really Moshe's speech, it's like what you said in the back, it was his calling because he heard God's speech. That is more chaviv, that is more dear to me than all that gold and precious stones that everybody else brought. Teda lecha shehu kein, and here's like the editor's note. You should know that this is true, that what God said is true. Shemikulam lo kara hadibur ela lemoshe, dichtiv vayikra el Moshe. Because the pasuk says only vayikra el Moshe above all else, above anyone else. In other words, what Rabbi Tenchuma does to our opening pasuk, which we simply read as Vayikra Moshe Vayidaber Hashem Elav Me'ol Moed, right? God called to him and spoke to him. The Midrash inserts the word rak only. Vayikra, that's not a throwaway word. That is highly loaded, and God only spoke to Moshe. That, in fact, was Moshe's donation to God. This is my reading. His donation to God is that he was present and ready and able to hear the dibur, whereas everybody else was busy giving the material stuff, which is the subject of other sermons of praise, that in this case, right, compared to Moshe's dibur, how can you even look at those jewels as being valuable? Dibur, relationship, is the most chaviv. Very interesting, right? Now you could say, this doesn't really help me because this is about Moshe, but if you would follow in Vayikra Rabbah, all of the selections that are focused on this opening word or verse, Vayikra Moshe, develop a series of sermons that focus on how chaviv we as Jews are to God because of our relationship to him through the Torah. So it starts with Moshe, but it becomes the opportunity to talk about, again, remember where the rabbis and when they were living. Everywhere around them, it seemed quite clear that they were passed over, right? And not in the Pesach sense, but the Christians were on the rise. The landscape of Eretz Israel in the 4th and 5th century was dotted with churches. The major tenet of Christianity was to say, right, we have a New Testament with God. You guys are over. Look at all the signs. Your temple has been destroyed. Many of you have been exiled. And the audacity of the Midrash is to say, no, actually, we still hold that place with God. We are chaviv with God. And how do we know it? We know it from our Torah. So Midrash becomes almost the vehicle for national survival, right? Read it more carefully. Come back to the text with me. Don't look outside, right? Don't listen to what they're saying. We have all the tools we need just from our Torah. God gave us this eternal gift that we can keep turning to find renewal in our relationship with him. We have about 10 minutes left, and I want to just give you, I don't know how that happened, just a hint of one other example from a different subject, not Korbanot in Vayikra, but Tumen Tahara, which was mentioned earlier. If you look at the next source here, all right, Parsha Tazria, which is coming up, well, not yet. It's a subject that the Parsha that I studied, so it always feels to me like it's coming soon. But Tazria is in the middle of Vayikra, and Tazria begins with the subject of the Korbanot that a woman would give after she has a child, right? It's very, very brief, very problematic. And the question that is always asked on those psukim is what?
Why the difference
between the boy child and the girl child, right? Because it seems that, well, according to the psukim, a woman would be separate from the mikdash and separate from her husband double the time for a girl child than a boy child. No explanation of the psukim, right? Actually, there are no good explanations out there. Many attempts. None are thoroughly convincing. We don't understand it. Chazal and Vayikra Rabbah are simply not bothered by that question. They have many more pressing matters to deal with on the Pesukim and Tazria. And again, in a nutshell, since we don't have time to look at it in its entirety, the Pesukim begin, Isha ki Tazria ve'yalda zachar. Okay, a woman who, Tazria, it's actually a very unusual verb. It sounds quite active, right? But she brings forth seed, the yalda zachar, and she gives birth to a child, right? What should she do? Then she has to bring the following korbanot. The subject of that pasuk entirely is isha. We're missing two people or two personalities in the birth of a child, clearly the husband and God. Okay, now we only know that God is missing because if you look in the rest of Tanakh, God is hardly ever missing in the conception or birth of children. Right? How many times in Bereishit, for example, right? It's very clear that God allows women to become pregnant. It's not something to be taken for granted, except in the genealogical lists, right? But any of the people that we actually study, it's a significant moment when God is literally poteach et harechem, opening up the womb. What happens in the Midrash, again, women were not able to bring these korbanot after giving birth to children. And so to use them as an opportunity to really focus on the details of the korbanot was not going to get you very far in terms of, a take-home message. What the Midrash does in this particular parasha on Isha Ki Tazria is it transforms that pasuk from the beginnings of prescriptions for korbanot into the opportunity of raising consciousness that God is involved in every single stage of a child's conception, the pregnancy, and delivery. So where God is not found in that pasuk, Isha ki tazria ve'adah zachar, the Midrash inserts God at every possible moment, heightening an awareness that the birth of every child is not something to be taken for granted at all, but rather, when you're experiencing it, it's an opportunity to remember how present God is in our lives. And all of us, since we are all the products of a pregnancy and a birth, every day becomes an opportunity to remember that we had and still have this special relationship with God. So the new relationship that's forged through the Midrash is not Isha v'yeled, but rather Hashem v'yeled. So let me show you one example inside of how this gets done. So again, on our sheet, this is Vayikra Rava, Margoliot, Parsha Tazria, Parsha Yadalad. So it's the 14th chapter in the Midrashic book. And it's the third comment. And again, here we don't have Rabbi so-and-so Patach, but it begins with a pasuk from Iov. So now you're already used to this. This is a Petichta. Begins with the pasuk from Iov. Chaim v'chesed asita imadi u'pkuratcha shamra ruchi. Right? You performed chaim and chesed with me, life and kindness, and your pikuda, your providence, watched over my spirit. Now, since I already told you what the message of the petichta is, that seems like a really good pasuk for the message. Right? It has nothing to do with the mother. It has to do with the fetus. Right? Chaim v'chesed asita imadi. What the petichta does is it itemizes all the different kindnesses that God does for the vlad, for the fetus, throughout the stages of gestation and delivery. For example, okay? Let's skip, in the interest of time. The first three are all Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana. He had three things to say. They're actually somewhat dicey and need a lot of time to parse, so we're going to skip them for today. Have to do them another time. Look at number four, Amar Rab Elazar. Amar Rab Elazar, Im yishe adam bekamin sha'a achat eno meit, u'me'eha shela isha merutachin, v'havlad natun betoch me'eha, Vakadosh Baruch Hu Mishamro Shelo Yaseh Shapir Shelo Yaseh Shilia Shelo Yaseh Sandal Ve'ein Zechayim V'chesed. Says Rabbi Elazar, if a person were to be inside an oven for even 1 hour, wouldn't he die? And yet the innards of a woman are boiling, and the vlad is inside the me'ayim. And God protects the vlad so that he doesn't become, and those three things at the end of the phrase are different types nebuch of miscarriage. V'ein zeh chayim v'chesed. Is this not chayim v'chesed? Now, this is a funny notion, okay? The fetus is not actually in a, boiling place. This was a common idea in the ancient world. You actually find it in Aristotle. You find it in the Hippocratic writings on midwifery. And this was a common idea that the womb was compared to an oven. Now, what's interesting here, the way that Chazal read it, is that left alone, right, in the natural course of things, what should happen when the baby is in the mother's womb? The baby shouldn't make it. The only reason why the baby makes it is because there's this extra level of shmirah that comes from God. In fact, this whole petichta kind of dramatizes all of the natural extensions of what happens in pregnancy that shouldn't allow the child to make it. And the only reason why a child makes it again is because of the level of shmirah. Take a look at Rabbi Tachlifa, the next one. This one, I think, is actually comic relief in earnest. Im achal adam prusa achar prusa, lo shniya dochet harishona, v'haisha hazu kama ma'achal hi ochelet, v'kama mashka hi shota, v'eino dochet et havlad. Ein zachayim v'chesed. It says Rabbi Tachlifa Kesariah, perhaps watching his wife or other women, he says, if a person were to eat a piece of bread, right, one after the other, wouldn't the second push out the first? And yet, how much food and how much drink does this woman consume when she's pregnant and does not push the child out? Now, you could read this in a very negative way and say, wait, do they think that the digestive tract and the reproductive tract were connected? No, I don't think so. Although there were a lot of misconceptions about the body in the ancient world. Here, right, he is, again, there's a kind of visual screen. There's a barrier between what's happening with the baby and what people on the outside see. And Rabbi Tachlifa is using that as an opportunity to say, it's really quite amazing. There's no analogy, right? This doesn't work out when we think of it in terms of the rest of the way in which we behave. It has to be because God is side by side with the child. Where we end up in the end, all right, well, I'm skipping to the very last one. Amar Rabbi Meir, it's on your page. Amar Rabbi Meir, Kol tish'a chodashim, she'en ha'isha ro'a dam, badin hu shetehe ro'a. Ma ha'kadosh baruch hu oseh, mesalko lemala midadeha ve'oseh otach halav, kedei sheyetzei havlad, v'hiye lo mazon lema'achal. Rabbi Meir extends this level of kindness, providence, hashkacha, not just in gestation survival in the womb, but also post-delivery. And he says all 9 months that a woman does not see blood, badin hu, right? Not din in terms of halacha, but badin from the way that the body was understood. And again, this is straight out of Aristotle. The understanding was that menstrual blood that was not evacuated from the body was transformed into breast milk. Rabbi Meir uses this as an opportunity, again, he's not interested here in transmitting medical theories like Aristotle was. He's using it as an opportunity to talk about, look what God does. Now, we know that's not true. I saw your shrug in the back, right? We know that's not how it actually is created. It doesn't matter, right? I mean, it matters, but it doesn't matter in this case. What Rabbi Meir is doing is, again, dramatizing the level of hashkacha that God has for each vlad, not because we're really interested in the mechanics of childbirth, but because it is a useful sermon, take-home message, if you will, for everybody, that we all experience this level of hashkacha all 9 months that we were in our mother's wombs. And so whenever we are feeling lacking in praise for God, we can come back to those moments and to this pasuk, which becomes a convenient catch-all, Isha ki tazia v'yada zachar, and we can recall, not literally, we can't remember it, but we can recall through the midrashim the endless kindnesses that God offered, shepherding us through the entire process into life and beyond. Isha ki tazia v'yada zachar. So we see here two very interesting and different examples of how the Midrash, again, in this one particular collection, uses biblical interpretation as a way of reviving, revitalizing, right, and breathing new meaning into psukim that are particularly thorny in a post-Chorban era. We have a lot to learn from Vayikra Rabbah, and I hope that you, now that you've been exposed a little bit, you can open it up, and it's been translated very nicely into English. And if you want to find useful material, if you're ever given the task of a Dvar Torah in Vayikra, you'll know where to go. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.